This is part one of a session, of a two-part session on peacemaking issues. I told you at the beginning of the winter program that I am very passionate about this issue. I hope when we leave Holden Village that my life will be more centered around reconciliation and peacemaking issues than it's even been in the past years. I think since 1972, John and I both have been very interested in examining the whole issue of nonviolence to see if nonviolence was really a way of life for us. It was a question that rattled our cages when we were in protest marches and civil rights campaigns, in peace marches in Washington, D.C. in the late 60s and early 70s. But we wanted to know if it was a fad. We didn't want to become like many of our liberal friends who said they were basket cases after those marches were over. It was a time when the church took to the streets, and if you kind of weren't on the streets, you just weren't with it. But we wondered if it was more than that, if it could ever be part of our core of our being, part of something around which our life revolved. And so we've been interested in the peace issue, have been doing some studying, have realized that peace and justice issues are so closely connected that it's impossible to separate them. Now, I don't know how you feel about peacemaking issues in relationship to having it be talked about in church. I wish you would talk with one other person for just a little bit about how you have come to your opinions about war, peace, about the nuclear arms issues, about disarmament or not disarming. Talk with one other person about what has formed and shaped your opinions. Has the church had anything to do with the way you feel now about peacemaking issues? Was it a bishop, a pastor, a friend, the newspapers? Just talk for a little bit with one other person about what has formed and shaped your feelings right now about peace or war.
Situation where the blind is, you know, who knows if this view is should be hereditary or treatable, like an
class.
So what person
what is right for me as a relationships
that I've started working on.
I mean, where you felt terrific conflict between these relationships that brought you to the realization.
And how I dealt with the conflict in those relationships. And the metamorphosis I saw, the different ways I saw the different things I did. And the things that made for peace in my life seemed to relate to larger truths, what was for peace in our world.
So you're telling me that you were able to deal with the conflict situation and with the past
rather than the past the aggressive and assertive approach. And that seems to me that includes some processes and sometimes people equate that quietism for all.
So it's been a personal life experience. It isn't something that you necessarily saw in scripture. Your church
not really. All of those things enter into it, but I don't think that they. The biggest grounding for me has been the changes that I've seen in relationships, the healing, the reconciliation issue.
Yeah, I was brought up in
the church community, which really is, to me, a very shallow. It's funny how nothing was really ever related. It was very personal.
Not much to do with life.
Yeah, that's sad. That's a change. I guess I have ideas, like I'm not really for a nuclear freeze. And I just don't. I'd say that I won't care. I just would rather be building the smell of God. It's cool as that. I think that's kind of crazy. But I think that's what I have for somewhere.
Okay.
Hello.
Are you there? All right. Would any of you be willing to share with a wider group what has shaped your life or your opinion about how you feel now about war peace issues or nuclear arms or whatever? Was your opinion not formed up until that time, or did you change your ideas?
John Nelson had a lot of influence, and that's some years ago. Okay.
Does everybody know who John Nelson is?
No.
He's an LCA pastor who has time and again put his body on the line by climbing over fences to protest the Trident submarine at Bangor. He has gone out in boats to try to stop the submarine from leaving port. His mother, Ruth Youngdahl Nelson, who was voted Mother of the Year some years ago, also goes out with him. Just about every protest that happens, at least where there are Lutherans involved, you find John Nelson. He has a marvelous sense of humor. I don't think he takes himself too seriously, But he has a very powerful statement to make, and people who maybe don't even change their opinion about the arms race can't help but love John Nelson when he comes to visit the congregation. Other people, how were your ideas formed and shaped?
Holden Village.
Holden Village? Okay. David?
I was telling Ed about one experience I think really, really began for me was when I was in college, and it was when I was first there, and Elie Wiesel came and gave a speech that really opened up my eyes to the human suffering of war, whereas I've been able to talk about the history courses and the objectives of a war and all that kind of stuff. It wasn't anything new that I can really say, it's just that it was obvious in him how much he as a person had suffered and had to struggle with the rest of his life, had been dealing with this, and it just had such an impact on me that I got a copy of his speech, and I remember reading it 10 times. I mean, I just read it and read it and read it. And the next year in school, I tried to write a paper about it, and I just was trying to deal with it. All he really did for me was he opened my eyes to the human element and just the suffering.
Okay. Does everyone know who Elie Wiesel is? Do you want to explain who he is?
Well, he was a Jewish boy in Hungary.
I thought it was in Germany, but I'm not.
Well,
I
his home was somewhere. It was not in Germany, but he got swept up by the Nazis and taken to Auschwitz, and saw his father, withering away and dying and taken away, and he survived the Holocaust, but barely. And just he's written a couple of short books, autobiographies that are just incredible. I've read it, and he just. You go through what happened during those days.
His book called Night is one of the most powerful books that you can read about the Holocaust.
It's not Night. It's really short. You can read it in about an hour and a half.
Also, one of the best tapes in the tape library is on Elie Wiesel, Robert McAfee Brown.
Okay, thanks. Anybody else want to share what's formed their opinions?
Well, I have a question for Davis.
What is your opinion? No.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't see anyone arguing over the horrors of war.
Well,
but how did that shape your attitude towards preventing war?
Well, I think until then, it had been easy. I mean, I'd never been so fully exposed to just the one human being and how he suffered and how that must have meant so many others did. And my exposure to war had been in classrooms. And reading through newspapers and how our mission, we're trying to prevent this from happening, we're trying to, achieve a purpose through war. And it just, all that just seemed so irrelevant once I saw what effect it had on a person and what it must mean to,
So it made you less willing to use military aid?
Oh, yeah, it's true, very much so.
Has anyone here had their opinion shaped by what they heard from the pulpit or in Christian education? Do you want to share?
Well, primarily in a class in seminary, though it was really not what the professor said so much is the fact that I took that opportunity to write a paper exploring the question of what I as a Christian believed about the use of.
And what conclusion did you come to?
I came out, much to my surprise, to be a fairly solid pacifist based on the New Testament primarily. And that was 1976, and I've been hoping ever since for someone to convince me otherwise, but I've only become more firmly entrenched as I continue to study and learn.
Anyone besides Bill come to a pacifist stance by reading the New Testament?
I think I have, partially through the New Testament and through the influence of people like Jim Douglas. Jim Douglas's thoughts helped me to see what action I could take, and the New Testament helped me to see the need for nonviolence.
Does everybody know who Jim Douglas is? Okay, why don't you explain that?
He's a co-founder of Ground Zero Center for Nonviolence Faith, which is in Bangor, Washington. and then a lot of resistance there and during the Vietnam War too, against the Trident submarine, against the Vietnam War.
He's a theologian.
Yeah, he's taught at Notre Dame.
Two excellent books by him, The Nonviolent Cross and Lightning East to West, both by Jim Douglas, are both in the library in the bookstore if you want to do further reading.
Resistance and Contemplation.
And Resistance and Contemplation, that's right.
The Nonviolent Cross is probably the single most influential book in my personal.
Did you hear that? Nonviolent Cross to Bill is probably the most single influential book in his developing what he thinks about it. Were you in the service?
I was in Vietnam.
How many years?
Pardon?
How many years?
Vietnam for a year and 2 year draft.
And what opinion have you come to, Dean?
Never want to do it again. To actually see firsthand the devastation, not only of the country and the people, but of yourself and the people around you.
It'll be a year on May 2nd that God's Promise and Our Response, The Challenge of Peace, a pastoral letter on war and peace by the National Conference of Bishops, was David Brinkley's headline story. I remember I was out of the village, and he came on and said, today the Roman Catholic bishops have issued, I don't know whether it was a second or third draft of a pastoral letter, fourth draft, was it? I've never seen a religious group like that who have written a paper making headlines on television. I hope it isn't the final draft because until we start, when we stop thinking about it or drafting letters or statements, I think we become very apathetic. And Chuck Lutz from the ALC has coined a word which is most Lutherans, passivism. Is that how you spell it? Passive I. Passive. Well, you know what I mean. Passivism as opposed to, I didn't even ask you, Ed, about your stance because I assume coming from the Mennonite church that you are a pacifist. Is that correct? But this is not to be confused with passivism, which is Ed's branch of Christianity and I hope New Testament Christianity, but it is passivism. We become very, very passive. The bishop said that it is our moral responsibility to look at the theological and moral aspects of the arms race. Since then, some of the Lutheran churches have come to the foreground with a few things. Our ALC church drafted a statement called Mandate for Peacemaking in 1982. The ALC declares in its judgment that any use of weapons of mass destruction is immoral. The ALC believes the goal of U.S. policy is the elimination of nuclear weapons from the earth. The LCA made a statement also that since has been burned and rewritten. They're in the process of rewriting again, and it's going to be discussed at the convention in Toronto in July, is it, Dan? I have not seen a copy, a rough draft of the new statement, but the first one certainly was not nearly as strong as the American Lutheran Church statement. But when you get down to specifics, then that's where the waters get very, very muddy, and people then begin to back off. Half of the people at our American Lutheran Church district conventions thought that the arms race was a faith issue, and the other half did not. In fact, a good pastor friend of ours had an article in the Lutheran Standard, which is the American Lutheran Church official paper, and he said, Luther used a political convention at Worms to make a faith statement. We use faith conventions to make political statements. When we talk about the arms race, I thoroughly disagree with that. The Rocky Mountain District, for instance, spent 2 hours debating a resolution to speak out against putting the MX missile in Montana. A third of the people polled at another district convention had never even thought about, studied, seen a television presentation about any kind of Holocaust or what arms and war might mean. But I think we come down to the fact that many of us do not see peacemaking as a vital matter of life and death. Maybe literally life and death, but certainly not spiritual life and death, if I can divide that for right now. We don't see that it has much to do with the gospel. We are passivists because we say we don't have the answers. We've got to leave it up to the people who really understand these things, who know what the Russians are saying. John's first congregation, our first parish, was a new mission in Annandale, Virginia, and many, many of the people there were military. And there was nothing that put you down more than when you'd start to talk about something and a CIA person or a military person would say, but if you knew what we knew, well, you just felt kind of washed out when that statement was made, because that assumed that if you really knew the threat that the enemy was, or if you could understand the covert activities that are going on right in our backyard in Central America, you wouldn't be so naive as to think that the gospel of Jesus Christ has anything at all to say about whether we build arms or whether we do not. So, is this a political thing, or is it a matter of faith? And I think until we see it as a matter of faith, and that's where I'm coming at today, is that I want to look at this as a faith issue. Now, I'm going to ask you all to stand up for a moment, and I want you to pretend that this is sit down until I'm done with you. This is number one, and the green hymnals at the other end of the room are number 10. I want you to, and the cross or the candle will be number 5, okay? On a scale of 1 to 10, this being very pessimistic and that being very optimistic, how do you feel about the future of our world by the year 2000? 1 is extremely pessimistic and 10 is very optimistic. Would you just think for a moment, and don't be influenced by where other people plant themselves, but go stand on this imaginary line. I'd like to see where you put yourselves. Okay, stand up.
Is this for the world or for our world?
The world. Our world.
The Earth.
The
Earth.
The Earth. The planet Earth.
Mary, you want non-pessimistic?
Oh, sure. I want everybody.
Where's very pessimistic?
Very pessimistic is down here, and very optimistic is down here.
It's for my life.
That's
for the world.
Well, would you say you're at number 2 or number 1?
I'd say I'm about 1.5.
1.5. You're about
3.
2 or 3.
Oh, I'm sorry, I'm at
2. 2.5. Okay, we've got about half the group up till 4. We've got about 5 people standing in the middle, and 6, 7. Nobody is 8, 9, or 10. Is that right? Okay, thank you. Okay,
yeah,
that's,
me too.
I'm very pessimistic, but somewhat
hopeful. Nobody wants
to smell the green book.
Nobody wants. I noticed the Catholics
didn't
go
that way.
Now, wait a minute. We're not going to talk about defining reality. Okay, I just wanted to get a general off-the-cuff kind of first feeling about, and there is a difference between pessimism and or optimism and hope from a theological standpoint. But just generally, okay, Charles, I didn't mean to throw that out, but why did you stand where you did?
Because I look at the situation right now, and it seems like there's war or some type of strife going on in every continent of the world, or some type of oppression. It seems like in a major way. And there are a lot of good things happening, but I guess that's why I was a 3, as I see tensions growing, as I see it.
Those of you that were down at 7, why were you there? What do you mean?
My view toward our world.
You see great hope for humankind changing?
I
Jean, you were down there. Do you have?
For me, it's a. I think for us to survive, I think we have to transform on every level. And I think that human odds of doing that are slim. And I also think that there is another power that's also working. And I think that we can still destroy the world, but I hope that that won't happen.
Anyone else care to share why they were standing where they did?
There's a lot more awareness, I think, and willingness to talk about it, even by those that maybe aren't for peace. I think someone will listen a little bit, maybe they can be brought over. And years ago, it seemed to me we didn't even talk about it.
Not being able to rest in my inability to imagine.
Where were you standing?
I thought of three.
Okay.
I mean, that's what I meant to be.
Ed, as a Mennonite, what would you say that most churches, that most people from the Mennonite tradition or Quakers or Church of the Brethren really have a strong stance personally, or is it something that they know that their church stands for, or is it really ingrained in the individual members of the congregations?
I would say that I've been a member of about several different churches, and I'd say several of them are, you find your Mennonite churches that as a congregation are on fire, and you find others that haven't even heard of the peace stance, so it's like any other church.
Do you know what our official stance is as Protestants and Roman Catholics, other than Quakers, Brethren, and Mennonites?
On
war, peace and war issues. What's our stance called?
Just
war theory, or justifiable war theory, which we'll talk about. I'm going to ask you, if you can, to write down what those criteria are in just a moment. There have been many, many arms agreements. I'm going to pass these around. I took this out of a book by Ruth Sievard, who does a lot of investigation. The research is absolutely excellent. She talks about the comparison of... she shows a lot how militarism and the injustices in the world are linked. There is a 1982 book in the library, and the 1983 book will be on the shelves very, very shortly, as soon as Linda gets it cataloged. But since the SALT agreements in 1971, I'm going to pass these around, but I just want you to see it if you turn the page sideways. The SALT agreements show that we had 4,500 anti-ballistic missiles in 71, and after the agreements, instead of it doing any good, it shot up to 10,000. USSR had 2,171 and it shot up to 7,400. So even with our agreements, not a lot is happening. I assume there are enough of these to go around. If you aren't interested, just give them back. But these are something you can look at. Now I want to take a couple of minutes and show you one of the main reasons why I think it is a faith issue. Because if we are to be whole people, if God's vision of shalom, which is that beautiful Hebrew word that means unity, and that we are to be physically and emotionally and spiritually whole, and that there is enough for all God's people, how militarism simply is the most anti-shalom thing we can think of, because it takes away from programs for the poor, for one thing. The budget of the United States last year was, I think, $506 billion. this is how the federal budget looks. This part all goes for military expenses. 44% goes for military things. 12%, I think this is too big here. 12% is for interests on past wars. We're still paying for World War I, II, Korea, and Vietnam. 4% goes for veterans' benefits. This is the domestic budget. 26% is for human resources. Yeah? Oh, I thought you were raising your hand. Six percent is for physical resources, and 8%, this is like energy and agriculture and things like that, and 8% is for running the government generally. All of the research for nuclear weapons and the development of weapons also comes out of the energy budget. So that's hidden in this 6%. So people who refuse to pay their war taxes or who take 60% or 50%, or if you just consider 44% for a direct military, if you still want to make sure that the veterans are cared for and that we have paid for our past wars. There is a reason why some people are being tax resistors. Now, Mark Twain said there are three kinds of lies: lies, damn lies, and statistics. And that's probably true, but I just want to mention a few things. First of all, let's start with some scripture. James said, "What causes wars and fighting among you? Is it not your passions that are at war with your members? You desire and you do not have, so you kill. You covet and cannot obtain, so you fight and wage war." Or Proverbs says, "Give me neither riches nor poverty, but feed me with the food that is necessary for me, lest I be full and deny thee and say, who is the Lord? Or lest I be poor and steal and profane the name of the Lord." Or a very harsh section in Ezekiel. God is speaking through the prophets and says, "And as for you, my flock, thus says the Lord God, behold, I judge between sheep and sheep and rams and he-goats. It is not enough for you to feed on the good pasture, that you must also tread down with your feet the rest of the pasture, and to drink of clear water, that you must foul the rest of the water with your feet. And must my sheep eat what you have trodden with your feet and drink what you have fouled with your feet? Therefore, thus says the Lord God, behold, I myself will judge between fat sheep and lean sheep, because you push with side and shoulder and thrusted all the weak with your horns till you have scattered them abroad. But I will save my flock, and they shall no longer be a prey, and I will judge between sheep and sheep, and I will set over them my own shepherd, my servant David, and he shall feed them, and be their shepherd, and I, the Lord their God, will be their God, and my servant David shall be prince among them. I, the Lord, thy God, have spoken." 34. Ezekiel 34. We are fat sheep, in case you didn't get that. And it is not enough for us to simply take, being 6% of the world's population, to take 40% of the world's goods and resources and 35% of the food. There is no justice and no equality in that, we understand. The gap between the rich and poor is getting wider and wider. In 1972, Henry Kissinger made a statement at the World Food Conference that within 10 years we would eliminate hunger from the world, and instead we still have 2 billion people who go to bed hungry at night. 4.5 billion people in the world, and 2 billion people still are undernourished. In fact, in the United States, the Conference of Mayors last year called hunger the most prevalent and insidious problem affecting the cities in our country. 2 million people live on incomes below $500 a year. Less than 10% of the children in the world have ever been immunized against anything. Less than 10%. In the third world, 1 in 3 who wants work cannot find a regular job. The U.S. military now the most powerful in the nation. The national poverty rate is now the highest in 17 years. There are 35 million people officially classified as poor under U.S. standards. We live on a deficit budget. Now, I'm not an economist, and so I will say it in terms that I can understand. If any of you know more about economy and can correct me if I'm wrong, I hope you'll say so, but this is the way that I understand it. We have a deficit budget because much of our spending is military. And this causes the government to compete for available money. They have to borrow money, and there's only so much money available. And so the government has to compete just like the private sector. And what does that do when everybody's trying to get money to borrow? It raises the interest rates, which again affects the poor, and it causes inflation. Military spending causes inflation because workers receive wages and consumer goods, but they don't produce anything useful. For gosh sakes, if there's anything we hope we don't use, it's what's being produced in our military sector. And so the supply and demand that we're so familiar with just doesn't work. They are producing things, they are getting wages for their work in producing military weapons, and there are all, normally they would be producing a product that would be on the market that could be purchased. Since they're not, there is a limited amount of consumer goods, and therefore that also raises the prices of consumer goods, which is another reason why inflation happens. More money earned in military sector competes for a limited amount of consumer goods and services. The government spent last year $175 billion more than it took in through taxes to pay for military weapons. And another thing is that defense contracts are a great source of profit. The interest, I mean, it's really good business to be building defense weapons. Investment earnings for corporations are 17.5. That was in the mid-60s, and I'm sorry, it's kind of an outdated statistic, but I think it shows you a little bit of what I'm talking about. In the mid-60s, the defense or the earnings were 17.5, and normally in other kind of commercial earnings, it was only 10.6. So again, that's a good source for the stockholders. 10% of the U.S. workforce depends on building weapons. And you'll notice that every congressman and senator, when they are going to maybe phase out a weapon, they get very, very upset because that's a loss of jobs. I heard on television a while back how excited Boeing was because they had a new defense contract, and it would mean good business for Seattle, which is so dependent upon Boeing for its livelihood. Unemployment is created because of our militarism, because no longer are military contracts demanding kind of your daily laborers. It's a very high technology kind of industry, and our men and women in this country are not always prepared to be in those positions, and so unemployment results. And Dan Erlander's excellent book, if you want one fine, fine book, easy to read, By Faith Alone, A Lutheran Looks at the Bomb, Dan shows all of the things, the jobs that can be created if we could spend $1 billion that we would spend in defense. We would create 187,000 more jobs in education, on health care, on construction, and so forth and so on, as compared to the military. Many, many, many more jobs could be used if we would put our money elsewhere instead of into military contracts. So instead of seeing justice as our basis for human security, we continue to increase our arms buildup, and we continue to sell arms to other countries, especially those that oppress people. And I can't think of a more pertinent example than El Salvador. To continue to give more and more money to El Salvador when the government there is a police state, the National Guard is continuing to torture people. But we see it as a communist threat and as an intolerable situation, and we certainly don't want in many countries to have our investments threatened. And so we always want to make sure that we provide in those countries a climate that is conducive for American businesses. And so we're willing to sell arms and send arms in order to beef up the government, even though many times they are oppressing our people, their people. Bill.
Well, before you leave economic sphere, the argument that is always brought is that, well, look what World War II did to pull us out of the Depression. I think the obvious answer is it wasn't military spending that did that. It was just plain spending. And had the federal government gone and spent that money on anything, building bridges and buses and roads, would have had the same effect, that it didn't need to be the war spending. But that's the classic argument. Mm-hmm.
Or that what this country needs is a good war to pull us out of our financial difficulties. Yeah, there must be a more creative
way. The additional argument is the one that you made, that defense spending today is so different from World War II. It's so capital intensive today, mm-hmm. rather than
labor intensive. An excellent, or two excellent books, one by a Roman Catholic, James McGinnis, and this one by Jack Nelson, a Lutheran, Hunger for Justice and Bread in Justice. If you've not done any education of yourself, for yourself, on this issue, I really think either one of these books would be simply excellent, because it ties together hunger and oppression in the world and militarism. Now, with all the money that we're spending, we are now being asked to spend $1.6 to $1.8 trillion over the next 5 years on military spending. The highest estimate I've heard is 1.8, and the lowest is 1.6, so I'll say 1.7 trillion. Do you have any idea how much money that is? All right, 11 seconds. This is just, I hope this is right. I've not checked this out, but somebody told me this once. 11 seconds would equal, I mean 11 mil, wait a minute. 1 million seconds equals 11 days. Okay, just to give you an idea of how many, okay, pretend like this is money, but we'll say seconds. 1 million seconds equals 11 days. 1 billion seconds equals 34 years. And 1 trillion seconds equals 34,000 years. Now, I can't even, 34,000 years, 1 trillion. And this is going to come in closer to $2 trillion we are being asked to spend. How much do you think, if you're a family of four, what are you going to spend each year for the next 5 years for defense, for military buildup? Just kidding. Do you know, anybody heard? Give me a wild guess. What do you think you pay in taxes? Most of you don't make this much money. Every family of four will spend $4,000 a year, will be taken in the way of taxes to pay for the 60% of the federal budget that builds arms. It is a faith issue, because if you haven't seen it before, that is absolutely idolatrous. To put our faith and our security instead of in a God of history who has in the past redeemed God's people, is doing that now and will continue to do so. Somehow or other, we think, God, you're behind a door. I mean, you don't really understand what's going on in this world. We do not feel safe. It is very important. It would be naive and stupid if we didn't continue to keep up with the Russians and build weapons. And so at the expense of many programs in this world, we are being asked to give $1.7 trillion. What really makes me angry is that last year, 140 billion was cut from domestic programs.
Last year?
Yes. At the same time that the military budget was being increased, they took 140 billion from domestic programs. 10% of the federal budget is targeted for very low income groups. And that cut that they put in the budget, 25% of the cut came out of that bottom 10% that's targeted for low income people. Do you understand what I'm saying? Make that clear. That's all right. 10% of the federal budget cuts, 10% of the federal budget is targeted for low income people. welfare recipients, etc. Of the cut that was made in the federal budget, 25% of the cut was taken from that lower 10%. Instead of, you know, military budget was increased. And now even when you hear on the radio that Hart or Mondale wants to cut down military spending, all they want to do is cut a little bit off of the projected increase. Nobody is saying, no, we're not going to increase it at all, or we're going to cut it way below.
McGovern.
He's but, out, though. Right, he dropped out after a very short amount of time.
The military budget in the 4 years of Trump administration has almost exactly doubled.
Is that right?
Inflation has gone up maybe 15% total, or not even that. From $140 billion to about $300 billion.
And if you don't think there is a problem in the United States with poor people, 25 million of us are malnourished. 25 million people in the United States, and the infant mortality rate on Native American reservations is some of the highest in the world. There are major problems here that we're not addressing. So it is a faith issue. It is not shalom when 25 million of my American brothers and sisters are malnourished, not even talking about the global picture. 10 million people in this country, children, have never seen a doctor. You walk in some of the hollers of West Virginia and you'll see that's true. Or in the inner cities, or again, on Indian reservations. To think that 10% of the 10 million people and kids in this country have never seen a doctor, I just find that hard to imagine. I saw an editorial in the Wenatchee World about a month ago where one of the Reagan administrators or administrative people had said that hunger did not exist in the United States. And the columnist, who is bald, said, oh, I wish Reagan would make a statement about baldness. Just say there is no baldness, and it would go away. Edie.
Along that, just after Mr. Meese made that infamous statement, I watched the Mark Russell comedy special, and he had a little ditty. Yeah, better be nice, not naughty and rude. Don't ask for things like shelter and food. Mr. Meese is coming
to town. Was it Meese that made that statement?
Yes. Oh, really.
Who could forget declaring ketchup a vegetable? Too.
Yeah. Oh. Little skit, you know, by a cartoonist with Reagan in the top cook's hat, and he said, "Hold your hands." And here was a ketchup for a little kid
pouring down into his hands. Do you realize that one Trident sub costs as much as education for 16 million people in third and fourth world countries? We could literally educate 16 million kids with what it costs to buy one Trident submarine.
What's the source for
that? It's either Siebert or Jack Nelson, Hunger for Justice. I think it's Nuclear Holocaust by Ron Sider. Which, if you want one single excellent book to read, next to Dan's, of course. Dan's isn't quite as complete as this one. I mean, I have three or four shelves on War Peace stuff in the bookstore, but I think if you're going to buy one book, this gives the theological, the statistical, the civilian-based defense options, which we're going to talk about next time we get together. But Nuclear Holocaust and Christian Hope by Ron Sider and Richard Taylor is just excellent. Gee. Sure.
Or it's being taped, isn't it?
I think it's being taped, yeah. But yeah, I could put together a sheet of things. Yeah.
Also, Martin Marty had a student study everything that's written in this area today to come up with one book, and that book is a recommended of all books that are on the market today.
What is it?
The Ron Sider.
Oh, Nuclear Holocaust. Yeah. Dan has in By Faith Alone this statement, and this came from Ruth Sievert's book too. Over the next 5 years, if we took just 3% of the $1.7 trillion, just 3%, this is what we could do. we could have a massive program to renew civilian industry, a worldwide vocational training for all disabled people, safe water for everyone within 10 years, a direct food aid program for the hungry, global assistance to small farmers, a key to eliminating hunger, worldwide primary school building and teacher training, a global effort to safely dispose of nuclear waste, a fivefold increase in tree planting, a worldwide clean air program, a program to vaccinate all of the children in the world, worldwide family planning and a global maternal health program, worldwide job training program for entrance into the labor force. This is not to be the final answer, but it's very illustrative of what you could do with just 3% of the money. You could do all of those things with 3% of the budget.
I don't know. I believe that.
Okay, Dan, am I wrong on that?
Well, are we I noticed, this was 3 years ago, and I noticed in the new edition, that I think it was so overcoded, and that, you know, that there, you know, there are so many variables. But I think the point she was, and she used ambiguous words when she, you know, because of course she could get in trouble, but she, what she wanted to show was just a vast project that could be done towards solving some of the world problems, which is a very small percentage of what the world spends on.
Or even if you took half of the budget.
Yeah.
I mean, you could still do, it's just, it doesn't make sense when we think, just in Central America, if we were helping to feed the people and helping them with their literacy campaigns and doing things like that instead of lining up troops on the Honduran border, how much more secure the whole hemisphere would be. Somehow or other, I don't think we've been seeing very, very clearly. Now, as I said, you can tell I haven't the foggiest idea of economics, but I finally boiled down my understanding of the military budget to what I have told you. So does anybody else have anything they'd like to add to that, or questions, comments, whatever?
Well, the example that I used to get a handle on the military budget was I took the price of my house a few years ago and bought it. It was $45,000. And if you gave away $45,000 every day for, I think it was about 8,700 years, you'd equal 1 year's military budget in the United States. So that's how I figured it out.
But I guess I want you to think very seriously about the possibility of being a war tax resister. There are 4 or 5 books. Tom Witt is going to be here pretty soon, and if there's a possible chance that he could do a session on war tax resistance, if anybody is interested in that, he also has a tape in the library. But more and more people are saying, I am not between the age of 18 and 25. I am not male. There is no way for me to be a conscientious objector. I am an over 50 woman who has no chance of saying, yeah, I am a CO, except by saying I refuse to spend $4,000 a year. Our family, it would be $6,000 a year to pay for weapons of mass destruction. Okay.
There's a book in the library on that. War Tax Resisters League, this one.
Right.
And then the other books are going this afternoon.
A Firm Life, Pay for Peace, War Tax Resisters Guide, People Pay for Peace, and one other one I can't remember. Would you pass these around, please? Now, how has the church responded to the war peace issue? There are 4 ways. Before you look at that, just don't look at it for a minute. Do you have a pencil and paper? I would like you to write down the justifiable war criteria. don't look at the paper. I just want to see how many of you know what your Lutheran, Roman Catholic, Presbyterian, or any other Protestant denomination, what the official's stance of the church, we call it the justifiable war criteria, which I like better than just calling it just war. I don't think there's any war that's just. But justifiable war. Does anybody know how many there are? Uh-huh. Okay, they vary depending on who does it, but in the ballpark. I'll tell you, I've got them divided into seven, and I don't care how many you get them. They were first formulated by Aristotle and Plato. Then Augustine revised them in the early years of the church, and then they were finally kind of put into their present form by Thomas Aquinas in 1200 sometime. Okay, and you have some things that take place before the war, during the war, and after the war. Can you put down any of them at all, good Lutheran people? Huh? First strike? Nope, that's not one of them. Yeah.
One of them must be the invasion of our territory.
If our territory is invaded, we can...
justified in...
Nope.
No.
They're not to bomb civilians. Okay, that's one of the things during the war. Non-combatants. Not injured. Okay, no non-combatant is to be injured. What else? Anybody, just give me. Did any of you get even three criteria? Bill? Karen? Okay, I just think that this is an example of how far we are from knowing even where our church stands on the war peace issue when we don't even know the justifiable war criteria. How can we ever know if it's permissible to resist the government if we don't even know what the justifiable war criteria are? Okay, what are some of the other criteria?
Last resort.
Okay, it has to be a last resort. Now, this is kind of a catch-all thing. How do you ever know that the war is a last resort? Have you tried civilian-based defense? Do we have a National Peace Academy? Has our president ever met the past president of Russia or the former premier of Russia? Have we ever gotten together to talk and talk and talk until we say there is absolutely no possible way of us reaching an agreement through negotiation? But a last resort is one of the first criteria. What else?
The war, it has to be there has to be a chance of resolving it through the war.
Okay, it has to be a reasonable chance of success. In other words, if you're just going to go out there and commit suicide nationally, that's not a reasonable chance for success. You can't just go and say, well, I know that they've got a million weapons and I have one. Now, you can talk about David and Goliath, and we'll get to that later. But it has to have a reasonable chance of success. What else?
Declared a legitimate state.
All right. This is why the Vietnam War got so many, at least Lutheran young men and women, thinking, because it was never declared by a legitimate... what's the word I want?
Authority.
Thank you. Congress never declared war, but you have to have the hierarchy of your country officially declare the war. All right, before the war, it has to be a last resort, reasonable chance of success declared by a legitimate authority. During the war, it has to make sure that no non-combatants are injured. And you know any more here?
It has to be conducted by the state, not just heroic.
Well, that's declared by a legitimate authority, yeah.
Can't use excessive force.
Okay,
it's
called proportionality. Right, proportionality. You can't, like in Vietnam, the example that's usually used is the general that said, we had to destroy the city in order to save it. You remember that quote? I mean, it's kind of stupid if you're just going to, if the end that you achieve is not, if the damage that you do in achieving the end is so horrendous, it does not make the war justifiable. Proportionality, not combatants, not injured. The last one I can think of, I can't think of the other one. After the war, you remember what it is? Mercy to the vanquished. This the United States is really good at. Whether it is, if there are any left, whether it's the Japanese or the Germans or whatever, I think we've been rather consistent in being merciful. I can't think for the life. Huh? That's true.
We didn't vanquish them, though. That's true. We were vanquished.
Oh, wait a minute here. There's one war under before the war. It has to be for a just cause, not for revenge. So, Edie, maybe that's what you said. But just because somebody comes in and invades our country, does that always mean that therefore we have just cause? You know, have we talked it through and so forth? Okay.
I thought of that very big of the impact just recently before I came to the movie World War III when the Russian force invaded Alaska to hijack the pipeline and use it as blackmail for grain. Supposedly sometime in the future when the grain embargo existed, and that was a mind bender.
Well, if you can see by my horrible writing up here, those were meant for kind of hand-to-hand combat when you had a sword and a shield and you could tell who was a non-combatant because they didn't have armor on. There was no chance of the women and children and the aged. Our little boy bomb that dropped on Hiroshima, do you know what the target was? A Roman Catholic church that was full of nuns. That was our target because it was the center of the city. There was no chance in a nuclear war that non-combatants would not be injured. Proportionality. It's insane to think that there would, I shouldn't just offer my opinion. Do you think it's possible? Do you get an idea that I have opinions about this? Is it possible to have a limited nuclear war? I mean, it's like fighting with one hand behind your back and you fight and fight with your left hand, but boy, if you're getting licked, it's going to be an amazing person that continues to keep that arm behind their back and say, well, I'm not going to bring it out and also use it to defend myself. Maybe it is possible, but it's not very probable that we would think of, or that proportionality would come into our justifiable war criteria. There are no winners in a nuclear war. Let me read you some statements. End of last June, I was out of the village, and I was watching the anniversary at Los Alamos, the 40th anniversary of the Trinity Project being where they developed the first atomic bomb. And there were 70 scientists who got together to form an anti-nuclear group who all signed a petition pleading with our government to get rid of its stockpile of nuclear weapons. Isidore Robbie, who worked with Robert Oppenheimer on the Manhattan Project, which it was called, stated that he got goose flesh all over him when he realized the success of what they had developed. And he said, I now call it an abomination, and my whole vocation in life is to eliminate it from the face of the earth. He has sorrow that Los Alamos still exists and says that he underestimated the wisdom of the politicians when he agreed to work on the Manhattan Project. The Los Alamos Weapons Lab developed the Minutemen and cruise missile warheads and the Trident, and the new assignment at Los Alamos is to design the Trident II, a missile warhead that will be 25 times more destructive than the first atomic bomb. And Oppenheimer quoted a Buddhist scripture and said, now I am become like death. I am a destroyer of the world. And what I had written down here was they were interviewing one of the scientists, Paul White, and the interviewer said, doesn't it seem strange? I mean, how do you feel about the moral aspects of working on weapons like this that are so massive in their destruction. And he said that the work is so exciting scientifically, but on the other side, it is a moral issue. But I have resolved it in my own mind before I took the job at Los Alamos. He said, I do not think, however, that I could ever work in a handgun factory, because handguns have killed more people in the past 40 years than nuclear weapons.
Well,
or somebody made the statement that Stone Age weapons, such as arrows, will not be good in the next war, but will be very good in the war following that. Bill.
I just hate to condemn these people too quickly, because they're... I don't think there are many people around hoping to use nuclear weapons. I mean, the people that are working in developing them really, I think, must be thinking of them as deterrents, and that we need... Everybody's against war, and we just need to deal with how do we best prevent it, and we need to argue against deterrents.
Okay, that's why I haven't taken this from a gospel standpoint up till this point. What does our faith say to us about even building weapons to threaten the lives of others? Anybody, Dave or Ed?
In a couple of debates I've seen on nuclear issues, one of them really threw me for a loop in that I see the traditional pacifist stance of being I wash my hands of nuclear weapons because they are against my faith, etc. But then different times I've seen people who I think are extremely sincere about peace who are dealing with the reality that missiles exist and therefore are negotiating with missiles as the terms of negotiation and are thinking about the reality. And I don't know what to say about that other than that just totally threw me for a loop, because I see I'm hiding and
You mean a pacifist stance can be one of hiding?
Sure. And it's an idealism which constantly draws people's consciousness. But as far as they exist, nuclear weapons exist, and I don't know how to deal with that. I don't know if I could ever come to the point of being someone who negotiated a SALT agreement and said, okay, you get rid of 5 of yours, we'll get rid of 5 of ours. That's almost even against a faith kind of thing even to deal in that. But yeah, that's what we have to do.
I mean, I hope I'm not sounding just extremely naive about this whole thing. And one thing that if we can't do in the church is to discuss it realistically and appreciate each other's opinions and being willing to listen. I mean, John accuses me, and I know this is true, I think I'm open on a lot of issues. I have a very hard time being open to any other stance regarding nuclear war except a pacifist position. And it is stupid. It is a stumbling block. It doesn't make any sense. It is simply relying and putting your trust in a God that the rest of the world doesn't understand.
I don't think it's stupid. I think you need, I'm far from thinking it's stupid. I think it needs to be linked with action, though, or it's not. If I don't link my stance with action, then all I'm doing is condemning someone else who is taking the only action they see available.
Okay.
And I'm not finding any action.
Pacifism is not passive pacifism is not passivism. It doesn't mean just sitting back and washing your hands. There is not a guiltless place to stand, whether you are a justifiable war person, whether you are a pacifist. Both of the pacifism position and the justifiable war position do have biblical basis. If you look at your sheets on the four positions held by Lutherans and most Protestants, passivism, the third column, there is no biblical basis for that. Claims that the matters of war and military policy should be left to the authorities. God wills that we should obey them at all times. The church is to be spiritual, preaching salvation so souls can go to heaven. The church should not be involved in political issues. Political decisions should be made by those who know best. And the last one, the crusade. If you brought the crusades, their favorite passage is in Jeremiah. Cursed is he who keeps back his sword. And so in the year 1099, 10,000 Muslims were beheaded by Christians because they were infidels. It's called, you know, we are, God fights for us on our side, and our job in the world is to get rid of the godless enemy. And I don't even know who my enemy is going to be tomorrow, but I have to listen to the radio so I hear our government say, today we are going to hate the Peruvians or the Nicaraguans or the Chinese. I mean, I'm kind of given an enemy for the day or the week or the year, it seems to me many times. And I fall into thinking, yeah, the Russians really are, well, they are a threat to us. They've got weapons that are aimed at us, and they're just as much of a threat to us as we are to them. But to kill a commie for Christ is not even a phrase. I mean, it's used. I've heard it used. McIntyre and other groups in the United States use that as a phrase. As our President Reagan said, he sees the all evil, and I don't want to misquote him, what was that, embodied in communism, all the evils of the world embodied in communism. That is a crusade statement. And there is no biblical basis for a crusade mentality that we have to kill our enemies or to kill a commie for Christ. In the justifiable war criteria, what should happen, but what is not now possible for Protestants, is that a young man or a woman should have the possibility to be a selective conscientious objector. You ought to be able to look at the justifiable war criteria and say, in World War II, yes, I really felt I could fight. In Vietnam, no, I didn't. In this war, no, I don't think I can fight. You are selective because you have faith objections based on scripture or on the justifiable war criteria. But there is no way that our government allows young men and women to be selective, conscientious objectors at this point. You can be a CO. Are you disagreeing?
Oh, I'm agreeing, yeah. Oh, saying
I thought maybe it's true. It had passed Congress when I wasn't listening or something. But that's something that we need to work on. Excuse me, Bill. What were you going to say?
Well, I don't know where you want to deal with this or if at all, but to me, a continuing problem is the fact that
no, I think we need to deal with it. I kind of like to save it for next time because I think it fits in very well. Karen? No, go ahead. Say what you want to say.
Well, I was just going to say that maybe it's not the United States responsible to have a Christian attitude towards war, but a moral attitude. And I think nuclear weapons are, to me, they're clearly immoral.
But it's not the role of the state to be moral, it's the role of the state to protect its national interests.
The state.
In state.
Okay,
the
but when our government...
back up whatever it thinks it's daily national.
When our government has a scenario of 20 million people in this country being killed as being acceptable, as was stated at the end of last year, is that a government that is protecting its people?
Well, that's the issue. It's not. I mean, I think from a political science point of view, the issue is not one of morality; it's one of national interest. And then the question is that.